In order for Monday, February 18th, 2008. Members, good to see you all here today. We are trying to get some time to have an informational hearing, which I will be carrying over from Friday. So I'm going to open up an informational hearing on the Oregon University System's presentation on good policy, good practices. And I'd like to invite our Chancellor, George Fernsteiner, to come up and talk with us for a little bit about what we discussed on Wednesday night of last week. With our guests and university systems work in this field. Welcome, Mr. Chancellor.
Well, thank you, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. For the record, George Kernsteiner with the Oregon University System, and thank you for the opportunity to join you this afternoon. Because it is a sunny afternoon, I will try to be as brief as is possible to be.
Thank you.
This is, while you can call it a response to good policy, good practice, this is really a discussion that also revolves around the strategic plan, which the State Board of Higher Education has, and really where we think we're going as a state and as a university system for the next 20-year period of time. What matters? What might we do? How do we set the stage for success over that period of time? You don't need me to tell you that we have a knowledge-based economy. You don't need me to tell you that that is the key to high-wage, high-skill jobs. The State Board of Higher Ed has adopted goals, and it has just four of them, and I don't know, I seem to be not doing very well with this microphone today. Does it come okay?
Yeah,
great.
Oh,
I guess it's just into my deaf ear. To create an educated citizenry and a competitive workforce while ensuring access for all Oregonians to quality education is the first goal. Ensuring high-quality student learning leading to success is the second. Creating original knowledge and advancing innovation is the third. And the fourth is to contribute to the economic, civic, and cultural life of communities in all regions of Oregon. Why do I mention those four goals? I mention the four goals because they lock together for the creation of that high-skill, high-wage economy that we were talking about before, and the fact that it is equally distributed around the state and equally distributed around the various people of the state. So it's a way of saying, in order for Oregon to be successful, all parts of it need to be successful, and all Oregonians need to be successful. And that's what the board's goals and its strategic plan are premised upon. We know that increasing college attainment is the board's top priority. And you'll recall the slide that Dennis and David provided to you last Wednesday, which talked about how Oregonians who are age 25 to 34 are less well-educated not only than their peers in other parts of the country and the world, but also considerably less well-educated than are people in the 45 to 54, 54 to 65, and almost any other age group that is older than the 25 to 34-year-olds and still in the workforce. We are not unique in that, but we are unusual in the slope of the line. And you can see also, by taking a look at the second slide, that education in this state is not equally distributed right now through all the counties. Some of the counties have a relatively higher proportion of their population that are educated at the associate degree, the bachelor's degree, or higher, whereas others do not. And that kind of disparity is also something that the board is concerned about as we look at how do we provide throughout the state the same level of opportunity, the same level of access that is enjoyed in some of the more metropolitan areas. In the 1990s, I think we in this state developed a false security. We knew that our economy was changing. It was changing from one that was based on natural resources to one that was based on high technology. And we rode that wave well in the 1990s and were viewed, and still are viewed, as one of the leaders of high-tech states around the country. That was true. But we, as Dennis Jones pointed out last Wednesday night, were 49th in job creation by startup companies. So what we did is we rode that wave with Intel and certain other large companies to an extent that exceeded that in other parts of the country. We had a great in-migration of highly educated people in the 1990s, and as you can see by the most recent data, we are beginning to see that not only has that peaked, but we are now bringing in more people from out of state who have a high school diploma or less than a high school diploma than those with a college degree, or more than a college degree. And that's a new phenomenon in the last few years that we did not see in the early parts of the 1990s, through the 1990s during the high-tech boom. So that we are no longer in a position, as Dennis and David pointed out, that we can ensure that we will import the educated talent that will keep our economy vibrant and moving. Never mind that that importation strategy never provided opportunities to Oregonians in the first place, but now that strategy, in their view, should be called into question because of changes that are happening elsewhere in the country and the kind of in-migration that we are seeing here. I want you to turn briefly to slide number 3, if you would. And I want you to look at this because we've never actually shared this whole sequence of data with you before. We are actually doing a lot better at moving students through to degree than we have ever done before. You can see that 15 years ago, only 48.8% of the freshmen who started in that year finished a degree in 6 years. And it's now up to almost 60%. That is good progress. That actually is what got us to the point that we are in the middle of the pack. We didn't start out in the middle of the pack. We started out well back in the pack. And now we're up to the middle of the pack. But frankly, as we know, as all of you know, that's not good enough if we're to be successful and if Oregonians are to be successful in the 21st century. You can turn to the next slide, if you will, and you can see that we have been increasing steadily in the number of bachelor's degrees, and you can say the same thing about graduate degrees, over the course of the last several years. And it's been a long-term trend upward that we are, in fact, producing more and more degrees each year. That may be about to stop, and I'll explain why in a minute. If you turn to the following slide, you can begin to see what the 1990s has meant. And I'm going to come back to that in a minute in particular. But if you look at the freshman participation rates, you will find that as you have invested, as the legislature, in higher education, students have responded. They have come. And that, in fact, is what has led to higher enrollments and higher number of graduates. So that we are beginning, we have seen that relationship, and you can see it's been a relationship that has occurred not just in the last, you know, year or two or five or ten, but even over a 30-year period of time. When the legislature invests, within a year or two, the participation rate of freshmen goes up. Students listen to what you say, they believe the investment, they come. But if you were to go back to that very first slide and look at the percentage of 25 to 34-year-old Oregonians who have degrees, and note that it is lower than that of any of the older people in the workforce, and note that it is lower than the national averages, and note that it is lower than that in many other countries, you ask yourself, how is it possible if we're generating more degrees, and if we're doing so more effectively and efficiently than we ever have before, how have we fallen back so far? And the answer is that this state grew, and grew rapidly in the 1990s in its population. One of the legacies of the budget reductions of Measure 5 was to reduce enrollment in the university system by about 4,000 students a year below where it would have been. That doesn't sound like a huge number, does it? But think about what it means over a 15-year period, and then apply a 60% graduation rate to that number, and you can see what it meant to that cohort of 24 or 25 to 34-year-olds. Far fewer of them have been educated than would have been educated under the system that we enjoyed prior to Measure 5. Now, you can argue all the things you want about the impacts of that, but the numbers are pretty stark. If we had educated those students, and we had done so as effectively as we are doing right now with the students we do have, our 25 to 34-year-olds would be at least as well educated as those throughout the rest of the country, and perhaps a bit more so. That really is something that we have to bear in mind. When Dennis and David said to you that the policy levers matter, one of the policy levers is the investment strategy of the state and the level at which the state is willing to appropriate funds for the support of the universities, the community colleges, and the students. And you can see that that can have an effect. But that isn't the only thing that has an effect, and I'm not going to argue that it is, because we have many more things. Otherwise, we'd be finished, and we're not finished. You can see that we've already begun to find an attenuation of the freshman participation rate from the peak after the 1999 investment. It is my hope that this past year, this year's investment, will begin to see the lines turn around again for next year and go back up. That would be the norm. That would be what we would expect. That is what we are still hopeful for. And in fact, at all of the meetings with high school counselors, at all of the sessions with admissions personnel, at all of the meetings that people hold to try to get a handle on the interest of high school seniors in coming to college the following fall, we are seeing the highest numbers in our history. We have turned the corner this year based on what you did last summer. You did two very important things last summer, and those will relate to some of the policy levers. The first thing that you did is you approved the shared responsibility model for the Oregon Opportunity Grant that provided for the first time in a very long time a big infusion of grant-based aid for students without the ability to pay for college otherwise. And you've basically said to the students, if you do your part and work a certain amount per week, if your family does its part under the federal guidelines, and you take advantage of the federal grant monies, that the state will also provide grant money to allow you to go to a community college, to a public university, or even to an independent university in this state. That's an important promise, and I think that's paying off in students' belief that the state's willing to invest in them. In addition, you provided additional support to the community colleges and the universities that have allowed them then to begin to ramp up their services to students and to hire additional faculty so that, in fact, they will be able to meet increased demand by students and meet it more effectively. And I think that's why you're seeing this big increase in interest in going to college this coming fall. So we're very hopeful. I can't guarantee anything here because we won't know till next fall, but all the signs have been positive with respect to enrollment for this coming fall. You will remember from what Dennis and David told you, the slides that we show on pages 6 and 7. And you can see that we have a much more rapidly growing older population than a younger population. But, and I think this is significant if you compare Oregon to many of the states in the Midwest, we are continuing to grow at every age group. That's important because it means that we will have a workforce that will be able to keep this state economically viable in the future if we're able to educate them. So we don't have to import people just to survive. They're here. We have to educate them to thrive. The second thing that we would note And it's something that Dennis and David talked about also, is the growing Hispanic Latino population. The fact that a very high proportion of the high school graduates in this state within the next few years will in fact come from that one demographic grouping. That historically, as you can see, in 1990, that was a relatively small proportion of the high school graduating population. Even in 2000, it was only about 5% of the high school graduating population. It's expected to go to about 25% before the end of the planning period that we're talking about, which then puts on us, going back to what I said in the first place as to the board's goals, they want to make sure that all Oregonians, regardless of where in the state they live or what group they come from or what their income characteristics are, that they have an opportunity for success in post-secondary education at both the community colleges and at the universities. In order to do that, we have to understand who the students are. So we take a look. We survey our graduates every couple of years. And in that survey, we ask a whole lot of questions. Among them, we ask our graduates, why did you choose to come to the university from which you just graduated? The answer overwhelmingly, in the first place, is academic quality, the program, and the second is affordability. When we ask students who didn't go on to college, why didn't you? The first answer we get is cost. It's affordability, as tempered by how they deal with a work schedule and a school schedule together. The third question that I think we need to ask, and we need to ask in communities around the state, and we're beginning to now, is do you really, really expect to go to college? And if not, why not? Because I think a lot of Oregonians have not yet gotten to the point of saying, college is something that is in my future. I think that the opportunity grant, the shared responsibility model, will go a long way to changing people's minds about whether or not they can put college into their futures. And I think the fact that this state has chosen to offer the opportunity grant even to part-time students, which many states have not, is again an indication that we will, as a state, work with the student who's willing to work with us in order that they can go to school and still work and still do all of the other things which they have to do in their lives. So I think the state has already pulled some of those policy levers that David and Dennis had talked about. A second group of issues really deal with preparation for college. And preparation for college has several dimensions, but part of it for us is clarity of our own admissions standards and policies. We know that if we are to have our high school graduates ready for the workforce and ready for post-secondary education, that we need to increase high school graduation standards. And the State Board of Education is doing just that. They have a big diploma effort going on that, in fact, will result in clearer, higher standards for high school graduation than we have had in the past. There are those who in the beginning said, you don't want higher standards because, in fact, students will be afraid of that. But what we've found is that that's not really the case. Students want to know what the expectations are, and they want to succeed in the workplace and in post-secondary education. So if you make clear to them what constitutes the measure they need to meet, we are confident, especially based on the experience in some other states, that in fact students will meet that. But that then puts another requirement on us. We have to make it clear to them from the outset, from the ninth grade, if you are successful in high school, then this is what it means for you in terms of admission to college, in terms of placement in courses, in terms of all of the other things that students have questions about at the start or at various times during their educational careers in high school. We are working on that now. Our faculty, the community college faculty, the high school faculty are working together to try to figure out how to make it clearer what those connection points are and how to make it clear when a student has reached a certain level of proficiency. What that will require us to do, and we are looking at it now, as I say, among the three groups of faculties, is how do you measure that proficiency? Is it based on tests? Is it based on portfolio assessment? Is it based on, given the 15 different essential skill areas, a combination? My suspicion is it may wind up being a combination. But those things are important, and they are part of a strategy for improving post-secondary performance for students in the state. If it is clear, if we know what we're trying to achieve, and if the students know what they have to achieve, I think it will make it a lot simpler in future for us to be able to say, these are our goals, and here is how we're going to get there. We know, too, that a lot of students are able and willing to do college-level work in high school. You've had discussion of that in your committee in the last session, in the session before. You passed Senate Bill 300. You've passed Senate Bill 342. You've talked about a whole variety of issues, and you've gotten reports on those, and I'm not going to go back through those again. But I think it's important to note that all of those efforts are geared toward improving communication with students, improving clarity for students, and improving their ability to move through to post-secondary degrees more effectively. We, in this past year, adopted for all 24 community colleges and universities a single set of scores for each of the advanced placement tests, so you know what credits you're going to get. And it's going to be the same whether you go to Chemeketa Community College or Southern Oregon University or Eastern Oregon or Univol. Doesn't matter. This is what it means. This is what you're going to be able to say. This is what you're going to be able to get. That kind of clarity, I think, is essential if we are, as a state, to have a policy of moving students forward. You don't want to do it by reducing academic standards, and that's not what we're doing. That's why, in doing that work, as in all this other work, we have involved the faculty from the universities, the community colleges, and, when appropriate, the high schools in setting common expectations. That's important because all three of those faculties have to work together in order to convey to the students a clear message that they can work all the way through their career. You know that we adopted the Oregon Transfer Module last time to ensure that for general education, for those students who didn't want to stay at the community college for the full 2 years and get an associate degree, which we have the associate degrees that transfer, that they could in fact know that what they took would count not just for a degree, but for the general education for any of the degrees. It's an important point to make because, again, you're down to the point of trying to say to students, we're going to make this as clear as we can so that you know what you have to do, and what you do here will in fact work for you as you move into the other segments or institutions within the system. One of the things which Dennis and David talked about at length on Wednesday night was financial incentives for performance. Since 1999, OUS has provided funding to its universities on the basis of completed enrollment. And I asked Dennis and David what they meant by completed enrollment, and they mean the same thing I do. So there was some, I didn't think they were clear on Wednesday night, that's why I asked them on Thursday. If you complete a course, that's the completed enrollment. Not if you complete the degree, that's a separate issue. But if you complete the course, which means you...
I thought they were...
I thought they said it was at 3 weeks.
Yeah, but we pay at the end of term. It's got to be finished before we pay. And that's been the case since 1999. We also, they talked about having, when do you give refunds? There's a pretty steep discount once the term starts to getting a refund. And it's to provide incentives, really, for students, once they've enrolled, to finish the courses that for which they have enrolled. And that's been the, that's been our policy since 1999. So that particular lever, we flipped or clicked or whatever the right term is a long time ago. What we're looking at now, and what we talked about with our board and with the presidents last fall, is beginning to find a way to pay the institutions a portion of their enrollment-related money, yes, for enrollment, completed courses, but also for improvements in retention and improvements in degree production. And the reason for that is we are trying to find ways to make what has already become a much more effective system than we used to be, and that's what chart three showed, even more so. Because even if we're now about 60%, that means 40% don't finish. So just because we're a lot better than we used to be doesn't mean we're good enough. And we're trying to find ways now to reward institutions who, in fact, move the needle on retention. And that'll be this coming year. And then hopefully in future years, move the needle on graduation above the expected levels. Again, what Dennis and David told you is institutions will do what it takes to earn the money. But we have to choose the incentives we want to use. We have to decide what do we want to pay for. And so we've historically, we have paid for courses completed. And I think the discussion we're having with our board is to begin to move that to a combination of courses completed, improvements in retention, and degrees awarded. And it'll take a while to get there. But in fact, it's a way of saying, this is what we value, and we're going to move in that direction.
Mr. Chairman, I hold you up there just for a second. Does anybody have any questions on that so far? That was kind of the central point of the meeting on Wednesday night. That's clear to everyone?
Yeah. I wonder, are there big differences among the institutions of higher education on this graduation rate? And would a reaction to it take into account the probability of graduating to begin with? And one thing we don't want, you could increase that rate a lot by only enrolling students who are certain to graduate. We want to not do that, I think.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlich, I think we'd have a tough time meeting our educated citizenry goal if we did that. What we're thinking about is a several-fold. We started this fall by saying to the campuses that we wanted to see them improve based on their own past track record. See, some of them actually educate a level, you know, a type of student who traditionally will, you know, roll right on through to a four-year degree, and they look a lot like some of the privates in that regard.
Yeah, you mentioned the Honor College at University.
Yeah, at the University. Yeah, the Honors College is a good example. Whereas, if you take a look at some of the other institutions that serve a lot of part-time students, Portland State's a good example, you don't have that same kind of a flow-through, and you don't have the same kind of measures that you could use at, say, University of Oregon. So what we did is to say, we're not comparing you to each other. We're comparing you to where you were. And we want you to improve on where you were, and then we'll begin to move the whole thing up. And so that's one piece of it. The second piece of it, and this comes out of something that they said the other night that I think bears a lot of consideration, and I kind of like the idea. And frankly, we hadn't done it, but I'm going to suggest to the board we consider it, and that is to try to find a way to pay more for students from high-risk groups. In other words, if you're from a group, And really, that's, we have to do that given the demographics of what will be happening. If we only are trying to serve the same kind of students we served 40 years ago, that's not the kind of student we're going to be getting. So we have to find a way to be effective with the kinds of students we will be serving, which will be a higher risk student in the way we usually think of things. And so I think we need to recognize that and pay for it. You do that with K-12 now in many ways. You have various, you know, gradations where you get different variations based on the average daily alpha. I always get that term wrong, ADMW. Some of them get different factors. And what we've done in the past is have that entirely based on what discipline you're taking, what courses you're taking, and what level you are. I think we may also have to have something that deals with who you are, you know, what kind of a characteristics you had coming in. We don't do that now, but it's certainly something we'd look at. And that would, I think, get directly at the issue you're talking about. It would also get directly at what I see as another major problem, and that's the chart two problem of the variations within the state. The rural counties, for the most part, there are some exceptions, but the rural counties, for the most part, have not participated to the same degree in the educated population as some of the more urban counties have. And unless you find a way to differentiate in how you do your outreach and your services, you know, you may not get any different result than we've had in the past, and that's not going to be good enough for us.
Mr. Chair, can,
yes,
can I comment on that?
You bet.
I was intrigued looking at that chart to ask, to what extent does this relate to the flight of kids who come from, say, Grant County or Gilliam County, graduate from school, and then want to work at Intel, which isn't going to be a job at Gilliam or Grant County?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, you've raised a couple of important issues there that deal with two dimensions of the what we've found to be some of the rural differences. The first is that students don't want to go a long way away from home in the first place. And if they do, they often don't come back, which is the family's fear that will happen. And the second is that there really aren't and have not been a lot of good jobs in some of those counties for educated people. And so we almost have to have a two-pronged strategy of economic development in certain of the counties as well as of education. And that's something I think over time we certainly need to think about how to bring those strategies together. I'll briefly touch on a few other of the policy levers that were in there. They asked that we assess enrollment by course. In fact, we do that routinely now. You can see, those of you who have read the documents from Eastern and Southern's retrenchment plans, that they look at every single class section to determine, is there enough enrollment to make this worthwhile? Do we continue to offer this kind of a program? What is less well known is that Oregon State, Portland State, they do that all the time as well. And I think it's important to recognize that they do pay attention to enrollment by course. Some of the campuses also have been involved in that project to re-engineer survey-level courses that David and Dennis talked about. PSU, in fact, was one of the 26 universities around the country that participated in that effort and did, in fact, design the national. They were the one assigned to do Spanish 101, 102, and 103, and Portland State, in fact, did do that. One thing that they didn't mention in the report that I think is very important if you're going to move students through to degree is what we call the bottleneck courses. It's the courses that are required for a degree, but you have more demand for them than you have room in them at any given time, so you're slowing students down because you don't have enough openings in the course that they need. We have campuses that look carefully at that every single term, open up additional sections like Portland State does, or begin to find substitutions. Because if you don't do that, if you don't actively manage that constantly, then in fact you wind up with people who are unable to finish in the right amount of time. Now there's umpteen examples where we haven't done a good job in that, and we have to do better. But we are aware of that, and I think it's one of the things they didn't talk about that probably we need to talk about is the bottleneck course situation. We do, as they have suggested, use each other's bricks and mortar. This state started several years ago offering OHSU's nursing program at the various campuses around the state. Eastern Oregon University has centers on a host of community college campuses. Portland State offers degrees out here at Chemeketa, not too far from here. You authorized last session Rogue Community College and Southern Oregon University to build a joint center in downtown Medford in order to make sure that students could move all the way through to degree without having to leave the metropolitan area of Medford or downtown. And, of course, OSU Cascades was built entirely on the premise that the first 2 years would be done at COCC and the last two would be done at OSU on the COCC campus. You will, depending upon the budget situation and the governor's budget proposal, you may see more proposals in 09-11 for four-year degrees offered at community college campuses. That's part of what we have learned. We went around the state this year and we talked to people. And we said, what is it that keeps you from going to college? And we found that whether it was in Burns or in Oregon City, it was that the campus was too far away. And we heard it just as much in Oregon City as we did in Burns, because downtown Portland is viewed as a place apart for a lot of the people in the metropolitan area. So we were beginning to look at, can we offer degree completion at various of the community college campuses in the metropolitan area, just as we do in various other parts of the state already. And they talk about year-round enrollment. You authorize us to offer year-round enrollment and with state support again in 1999 at the same time that you authorized us to pay for course completion as opposed to just general enrollment. So many of those policy levers have been pulled. We are doing some other things that are fairly controversial sometimes that I think can result in increasing the number of degrees and reducing the time to degree. The elimination of the tuition plateau is one, in that it focuses students' attention, really, because they're paying for every credit. It is controversial, and it has both, and I can argue both sides of that issue, but in fact, it is something that could contribute to that. I would note that we do have now a fairly strong student record system within OUS that allows us to track students regardless of which campus they're at. We have a lot of people who start at one and go to another. My son is one of those. He started at U of O, went to Portland State, and he's back at U of O. So I don't know how many records he has. He has one, because we have the ability to track those students through the system. That allows us then to assess their progress as they move forward. And as you know, because you've approved the data systems in the last session, we're beginning then to link with the high schools and the community colleges as well. How will we know if we've succeeded? Well, you've adopted for us 29 performance measures, and we do track all those performance measures. It's down from 50-something the previous biennium. But there are some that are really critical to us that we think are the most important of those. The measures of affordability, where we look at the percentage of family income in Oregon that it takes to go to college after you've taken out grant aid. That's something we track. When you adopted the shared responsibility model last time, a piece of that was, in fact, that tuition should grow at approximately the rate of growth in Oregon median family income. And that the appropriation you made for grant aid and the tuition which we proposed locked together with that premise in mind. And it's an attempt to keep the level of affordability over time. We look at freshman participation, because that tells us, are we reaching the high school students? Are they coming to us? We look at retention. Are we keeping them, or are we losing them before they finish the degree? And then we look at completion rates and degrees produced. We look at graduate outcomes and workforce development, grad satisfaction, internships, employment. And we look at research productivity. And I know this isn't the place to talk particularly about research productivity, but I know that our graduate students and our faculty are among the most productive in the country at getting federal grants and advancing, therefore, the frontiers of knowledge in various fields. That is important for competitive advantage in the 21st century. So it's not just about raising the education level, it's about also raising the knowledge base. What's on our to-do list? We have to improve college participation of underserved populations.
Chair, may I ask a question on that?
Yes.
I'm sure George knows he hit a nerve on mine. On page
page. I can't see the page number.
Anyway, on one of the pages in your report, page number's here somewhere. Oh, yeah, on page 7 of your report, you talk about the Portland Higher Education Committee addressing a wide array of topics in terms of Portland education. As you know, I've had a proposal, and you'll see it again in 2009, the Lord willing, and the creek don't rise, to help create a major research institution in the Portland area. You commissioned a report on that, and the first half of the report said there might not be economies of scale to do this, but the second half of the report I found most interesting said, if you actually dreamed about the possibility of doing this, there's pretty much only one way to do it, and that's ultimately merging PSU and OHSU. I was, whether or not you agree with my interpretation, I just said you don't have to agree with that. I was wondering, to what extent is the Portland Higher Education Committee looking at this kind of a merger, because it's really focused on improving both research and graduate education as an option.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, the committee is focused right now on figuring out the proposals it will bring to the board that will inform the 09 budget. And I know they are looking at a variety of joint research and joint education opportunities. They'll have both capital and an operating dimension to it. OHSU and PSU, along with U of O and OSU, have been part of that discussion from the very beginning, and it is entirely possible that the proposals that would come forward would have dimensions of programs from each of those institutions, and not just from OHSU and PSU. The committee has not, to this point, directly addressed the question of a merger.
Thank you. Would it be possible to speak with that committee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I will be happy to talk with the chair of the committee about that.
And that Jim?
That's Jim Francescone, yeah.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope it didn't distract too much.
No, thank you, Representative. I've always appreciated those questions.
where we need to go, we think, from here is to figure out how to serve underserved populations, be they first-generation, low-income, rural, or Latino-Hispanic. We need to find a way to connect OUS and the K-12 schools more closely at the ground level, and we're looking at ways of doing that. We need to connect our data systems across the education sectors to facilitate both our operations, which admission, enrollment, transfer, advising, and the understanding of student outcomes. And I think that's important. And you've seen proposals on this, you know, pieces of it over the last several years with K-12, with the community colleges, and with us. We need to foster strong partnerships across institutions and sectors. We need to serve the rural areas of Oregon with strong and financially sustainable institutions. And that may require that we look at operating them in somewhat different ways than we have in the past, particularly with regard to support functions. We need to support competitive research with a firm foundation of graduate education and a high-quality faculty, and develop the appropriate regulatory structure and incentives at the state level for us, the community colleges, and K-12 in order to optimize the number of degrees going forward. Now, don't ask me what all those things mean yet, because I don't know what all those things mean yet. My hope is that by next session we'll know more of what those things mean, but I think this is not a one-time, one-shot deal. This is a long-term engagement and commitment. There are some new initiatives that came out of the Good Policy, Good Practice report that we intend to pay more attention to than maybe we have in the past. The first is tracking down the former students who are getting closer to completion. Eastern did that this past year. They brought quite a few of them back, which is one of the reasons that their enrollment is as strong as it is. As you'll recall, Eastern was slated to have about a 6% reduction in enrollment, and instead, their enrollment's up by about a percent. Why? Aggressive recruiting on the part of the president and her staff, but part of that also was reaching out to students who hadn't yet completed, who'd gone away, maybe for as many as 2 or 3 or 4 years. And they went back to them and said, well, you know, why don't you come back? We need to do more of that. And I think that we will. We need to find a way to pay extra for serving at-risk and graduating at-risk students. It is more than serving. It has to be and graduating. You've got to move them through to degree. And we are looking at providing differential tuition, greater differentials than we have now, higher at some of the institutions than at others. And there's a reason for that. They actually do serve, as Representative Greenlick indicated, somewhat different markets. And if that's the case, it may be in the state's interest to recognize that, provide then more flexibility of tuition for certain of them, and more state support for serving at-risk students for others of them. And that, in fact, is something that our board will look at. But we need help. We need a lot of help. We need from you sustained support. Support that is both vocal and financial. We need to help enfranchise populations that have not been part of the new economy that we've seen in the last 15 years. The first generation students, the rural students, the Latino students. We have a plan. And Susan Weeks, I think, has shared it with you in the past. We've shown improvement. That's why I showed you that graph that indicated how we have improved our graduation rates so markedly over time. We have pulled out of the 100 policy levers that were in the good policy, good practice reports, we've already pulled two-thirds of them, and we're in the process of figuring out how to do another 15. We've actually done most of the things, or are doing most of the things they have talked about. And we have reasons for choosing not to do others, and I've already told you we're going to look at some of the others that we hadn't thought of doing. But that's not enough. It's not enough just to pull the levers. We have to set a goal. We have to develop the strategy. We have to implement the plan. And we have to measure progress. And we have to do it over and over again. Yes, this is a call to action for OUS, but we can't do it alone. You and the governor have to set that goal. You have to establish the tone, convey the urgency, and provide the consistent leadership that will allow Oregonians to be successful. And we're willing to help in any way we can to make that happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Chancellor. Questions? Comments? You've left them speechless, sir. It's astounding.
The weather.
I think it might very well be.
I'll make a comment.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chancellor, I enjoyed your report. I think especially appreciate how you outlined what you've looked at in this. Because as you know, I came back with my colleague, Representative Comp, and our administrator very enthused about this and saying, hey, now let's go out and attack that windmill. It sounds like you have started some of these things. And again, we were at this meeting and we were defending our state and what we're doing, some good things, and we're proud of those things we've done. And I think what you've outlined to us with this makes me feel a lot better, and that you're willing to look at these things. It took me a week in this building to find out that we're down here and it's all about money. And money is the key factor in what we're trying. It drives all of our policy decisions. So, I think we're proud of what we've done in the shared responsibility model. I think we're proud of what we've done to make sure credits. I read with interest obviously you don't like the reducing the number of hours to graduate, and that was one of the things that you didn't seem to like. But again, I think I appreciate your response and. I think we're going to talk to you about what can we do in the future to help you and help our state provide or gain this workforce we need to meet our future needs. So thank you for your work on this.
Thank you.
President Huffman.
Thank you, Chair. Hats off to Eastern Oregon, because I know projections going into the year were kind of grim. And sometimes it does take an emergency like that to start looking at how do we get our numbers up in this example. And, of course, in the business sales world, you know, it's well known that an existing or a past client is a whole lot cheaper to get or retain than going out getting new ones, and so that philosophy holds true there. Through the rest of the OUS is what Eastern Oregon had success with starting to filter down and be implemented. Is there going to be an aggressive attempt to re-grab some of those past students?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, I will begin the conversations with presidents on that topic probably this week. Some of the campuses are well equipped for that, and others, because of the kinds of institutions they are and who they serve, probably less so. And it gets back to beginning to be more intentional about the missions of each institution and who it's going to serve. The board has really been focused on that for the last year, this mission differentiation. So I think that in addition to Eastern, there will be others who will be focusing on sort of bringing back the adult student and helping the adult student become successful. Because really, as Dennis and David pointed out, that's probably the only way we're ever going to reach our numbers. We just don't have enough in the pipeline otherwise. But it was kind of eye-opening to see their numbers, and it kind of gives us a target.
Within rhythm.
It's something that wasn't talked about here, but I think personally is important, and that goes back to the intellectual capacity of our organizations and the physical capacity if we try to improve more. And I'd like, you know, answers on both of those. But in that intellectual capacity, we had it for a while, the opportunity for individual university presidents to have funds available for hiring staff so that they could get outside of the norms so they could keep people. And I have been watching the drain of some of our best research people going to other institutions who are paying more. And I'm still very concerned about the ability of our universities to maintain, keep the good people we have, and recruit people so that we continue to have that excellence that I think has been a part of our system. Any comments on either?
Mr. Chair, Representative Roblin, you're absolutely right. The key to our success will be to attract and retain excellent faculty. We have the ability with the budget you passed last time to add faculty at most of the campuses. And I know that the provosts, who are the chief academic officers, are in the process of searching for those positions now. It takes a while to do an academic search. With regard to the issue of retention attracting and retaining, it often comes down to how much we can pay in salary. Our salaries are about 85% to 86% of the national average for the peers. You appropriated $10 million in the last session to allow us to begin to bump that up slightly, and you can bet that that's going to be one of the things we will continue to ask the governor for support on in the 09 session. We need to pay our faculty more if we are to succeed. We know that.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Kimmel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor, I know Oregon State and Eastern Oregon years ago were kind of the leaders, along with the University of Utah, in distance education. And as a matter of fact, when I was reinstating my teaching license, one class that I took at OSU involved students and faculty from Utah and Eastern Oregon. What role is that play is distance education now and kind of hybriding our system playing in helping us bump the numbers up and helping us move students through the pipeline so that they can get their degree, maybe not have to go quite so far away, you know, from Ontario to Eugene, and hopefully they go from stay in state instead of going to Boise State,
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I don't have the data with me. We've had a fairly noticeable increase each year for the last 15 in sort of technology-enabled distance education classes. I know that what we have found recently at the two campuses you cite, Oregon State and Eastern being some good examples, they both have growing enrollment in those areas. But they also have, and this is interesting to me, although I understand why it could be, some of their current on-campus students are also taking courses via distance. because it fits into their schedules, it fits into their learning styles. So I think what we're seeing is a much richer array of options being offered to students that will allow them to continue to have courses in many different modes. But unfortunately, I didn't bring the numbers with me, so I'm...
That's fine.
Could I...
I just want... Yeah, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's fine that you don't have the numbers with you. I'm just trying to get a feel for... because it feels to me like that's the way education at all levels, K-12, community colleges, private universities, public universities, is kind of moving. And we will never dispense with the bricks and mortar operations, and I think that needs to be very well understood, because that wouldn't necessarily fit people's learning style either. But I was just curious, and which you answered my question, which is that it's continuing to increase, and now we're seeing students using it both on campus and off campus, and so it just becomes another medium by which we can offer classes. So if a class doesn't fit into a student's schedule at one time, maybe because it's offered online, it fits at that time. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Combs.
A follow-up to that, Chancellor. About 8 to 10 years ago, I was in the glorious state of Texas, and Texas has been very progressive in this area of online courses. Has part of the plan, or has Oregon looked at for retention and giving extra additional salaries for professors that the work that goes into creating a medical terminology class online with all the visual aids and the supports? Does Oregon do that, or how, if a person is taking an online class at the University of Oregon, who writes the curriculum? Is it done through the public entity or a private entity?
Chair Buckley, Representative Comp, if it's offered by us, typically it's done by the public entity. There are a few exceptions where we bring in courses from another university. For example, our Master of Library Science is really Emporia State's Master of Library Science. I mean, that's okay. But that's been a longstanding practice. But beyond that, you're going to get me out of my depth. So.
Well, thank you. And it's just that because I've been intrigued by this, originally at the university level, and yet that opportunity, as Representative Crummell knows, is I like that option for our other K-12 students, but the concept of paying private dollars is not always what we want to do for public education. And I was just wondering if there was something that was working in higher ed that has a model for us. But that's the premise of the question.
Representative Rubin.
Yeah, just a quick one. You know, it was wonderful from my perspective to watch as the whole Oregon thing lined up on the nanotechnology stuff. You've got Portland State, you've got OHSU, and you've got industry all kind of having that mentality keep growing together so that interesting things can come of that, and out of that comes an economy. You've got people on some of the community colleges who are working with different groups. So you've got some people on the Gorge that are working with the technology on wind. And I look at places like the solar technology that's happening in the Bend area and saying you've got community college there that I'm sure is working intimately with them to help develop technicians to work. But are we also compiling that with the higher ed to get the same kind of engineering and so on people so that the energy about it and the studying and the knowledge base continues to grow so that those other industries want to come there because that's where the hub of that kind of thing is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Roblin, the one of the areas that I think the board will be considering program expansion in will be in the entire arena of what amounts to green buildings, green technology. University of Oregon and Portland State are both very active in those areas. There are a variety of things that are under consideration right now, some of which relate to solar, as you indicated, or geothermal, which OIT right. does,
yeah.
and I think can extend and expand on. There's also the issue of wastewater treatment and some other things that I think are they don't get quite the headlines, but they may in fact be extraordinarily important. So, you know, and all of that is part of what we're talking about with the board and with one of the signature research centers that you created last time with Oregon Inc.
Representative Lim, we have time for one more question.
Yes, I have one question. Chancellor, according to the chart you have given me at page 7, and 2017, and expect the rapidly growing Latino populations, they are going to be 1 out of 4 students in high school. That's what it projected. And then eventually some of them are going to a higher ed, either community colleges or public education. What is your plan currently when the Latino population is getting bigger? And then what are we expecting at that time? Do we need more funding? And then are they able to support themselves going to the higher ed? And any projections, what we're expecting in the future, if not 2017 or 2020, whatever, in the beyond, because the Latino populations are continually growing and more, and then we need to know which directions we need to go.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, thank you for the question. The first thing we need to do is to focus on high school completion. That is also the population group that actually completes high school, receives the diploma at the lowest level of any of the major subgroups of the Oregon population. If we do that, then and we also do two other things that I talked about before. One is find a way to connect with families in rural and other underserved populations to convince them college is an option. And the second is to, and that went out of my head.
Dealing with the over 65, by the way.
Well, I know. let's see.
Opportunity grants, perhaps.
So the opportunity grants are essential because that has historically been a lower income population. And there's also a third.
Paid for the students when it's graduated.
Thank you. Yes. Providing support for the institutions that allows them to serve students who historically have not been successful in college. And, you know, Latino and Hispanic students are among those. Or not. So there are basically three things.
Okay. Follow-up questions?
Briefly, if you please.
Briefly, okay. While we are focusing our resources and energy to the underachieved or lower score student, whatever, are we neglecting the higher the student who could more achieve with the same amount of money? And where could we find the balance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, that's a question that the board has struggled with for the last several years. I mean, where is that right balance? Obviously, what we try to do is to optimize the level of degrees in Oregon. And the growing population is in the lower income groups that have not historically gone to college. But you can't ignore the other because those are critical also to our success. That's why we have honors colleges. We have tracked over the last dozen years or so our ability to keep the highest achieving high school graduates in state. For most of those years, we were doing a pretty good job. Year before last, we began to see a reduction in that again, and I'm going to be interested to see this coming fall whether the combination of the shared responsibility model and increased support for the colleges and universities will lead us to be able to bring those students back, because we saw that was the group that gained the quickest in 1999 in terms of our ability to reconnect with them. but we'll have to see.
Okay, just one comment.
Yes.
I hope we don't lose in our public education system that the one Edison. If one Edison could do a lot better than sometimes thousands of millions of people. So I just want to emphasize that.
Thank you, Representative. Well said. Mr. Chancellor, thank you very much for your wonderful report. I would just point out, though, on page 14, one line jumped out on me, and you don't need to comment on it now, but the line says, many of our state regulatory policies inhibit our ability to operate efficiently to be most productive. So I'm hoping that you will give us a list of those regulatory policies, and we'll be working together on those as we head towards 2009.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, members. And we are adjourned till tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Thank you very much.
Thank you.